Iranian firm launched its own line of products that have since replaced L'Oreal in many a Tehran hair salon. The company said its domestic focus allowed it to retain about 450 workers, as reported in 2020, like the next few examples. Iranian home appliance manufacturer Park Shamar Company made the most of the departure of LG Electronics and Samsung, the much larger South Korean competitors. Park Shamar made Iran's first domestically produced dishwashing machine, the Josephine, named after the machine's inventor, Josephine Cochran. Park Shamar's sales of dishwashers and washing machines surged 40% and 55% from 2018 to 2020, allowing the company to hire 600 workers. This, its marketing manager Mehrdad Nikzad said. Be it by manufacture or imports, some items just have to be provided, and Iran did this, our guest reminisces.
We made every effort to supply basic goods despite all the problems in the supply chain. We identified 24 goods that were essential for the people. Those included vegetable oil, rice, corn, medicine, and others. We planned for the 24 goods, taking into account all the factors influencing the supply, distribution, monitoring, and decision-making system so they can reach the 60 million Iranians easily and with the least amount of fluctuation in their prices to fully address the concerns of the citizens.
Naturally, no country can and should produce 100% of all the materials it needs on its own, because there's a discussion of comparative and absolute advantage. Every country has an advantage in producing products or providing services. Some powers with colonial histories use the matter to pressure sovereign nations. Since the day of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic in Iran, our enemies and those who consider their interests lost in Iran introduced sanctions against our country.
In the same year, 2020, about 1,000 small and medium-sized companies created or reinstated 17,000 jobs, the deputy head of Iran's Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization told IRNA. They accounted for 92% of this country's manufacturing enterprises and 45% of its industrial jobs, according to the organization. Iran's unemployment rate over the decade leading to 2020 had decreased to 9.5% from under 12.5%, according to government statistics. Now, if sanctions have inadvertently helped the country's industry, perhaps they've also set it on a path of independence of its crude oil exports. To what extent and what businesses have found an opportunity in limitations and shortcomings? The governing system here is neither liberal nor socialist. It supports private enterprise while supporting the poor as well via institutions such as the Imam Khomeini Aid Foundation. The actual functioning of these foundations are a platform for good work, if not at the expense of national economy or other echelons of society other than their protectees. That is... That'll be it for today, but do look out for more as we'll be back with the Vienna talks and whatnot, same time, same days. For now, bye from the whole team.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The urgent needs of the present time are usually quickly recognized by the masses of the people. And with a quick mention, they recognize them and enter the field. This was the case in the sacred defense era. Whenever Imam made the slightest mention of something, a deluge of people would take to the fields of battle. The same was true of recent events, such as defending the holy shrines. Of course, the vigilance of the Iranian nation in this regard is truly astonishing. They really enter the field vigilantly when necessary. A clear example of which in the past decades, as I said, was their presence in the front lines and presence in the confrontation with anti-revolutionary forces. The case of Tabriz in 1359 is an example in this regard. And there are other cases in other parts of the country as well. The people have done other activities as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The ninth of day was one of these activities. The people entered the arena voluntarily because they felt a need and they satisfied it. The same is true of scientific activities needed by country during the outbreak of the coronavirus. The young scientists of the country immediately began to work. We were witness up close to the activities. As soon as the issue was raised that a vaccine should be produced for this, scientists in different places and organizations began to work. And the result of their work is a variety of vaccines in the country that people used, as a result of which the country became needless of begging others. And it was not clear how many vaccines they would have given to us if they would have given any. If we had not produced it in our own, they would not have given us any. Such is the people's feeling about the urgent needs of the country and their fulfillment of those needs. The most recent example of the fulfillment of these needs is the people's presence in the 22nd of Bahman rally a few days ago. Today's 22nd of Bahman was astonishing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Everything appears to be getting increasingly expensive in America as prices for all kinds of goods have skyrocketed. And as a result, the budget of many Americans are in tatters, especially when it comes to essential needs such as prescription drugs. Those drugs are particularly more expensive than they are in the rest of the world, and the more vulnerable portions of society are failing to purchase the drugs they need to sustain a healthy life. Prescription drugs are indeed many times higher in the U.S. than in other developed nations, leading to the question, why is that so?
Pricey prescription drugs.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in today's episode, we'll ask a basic question with no simple answer. Why is the cost of prescription drugs so high in America compared to at least a dozen other developed nations? After all, the U.S. has the highest per capita pharmaceutical spending, which is mostly due to higher drug prices. For example, the U.S. spent $511 billion on medication in 2019. And in this episode, we'll try to get to the bottom of the pricey prescription drug and possible paths to lessen costs. I'll be joined by Jeffrey M. Young, a Democratic candidate for KY5 Kentucky, as well as New Jersey-based Ahmed El Tuni, co-chair at the Green Party of the United States. Thank you and stay tuned.
This was your compensation in 2017 for being CEO of Celgene, and that's a lot of money. Any increase in the price of Revlimid would also increase your bonus by increasing earnings. Isn't that right, Mr. Ellis?
If revenues increased and expenses did not, then earnings would be enhanced. And
thank you. In fact, you personally received half a million dollars personally just by tripling the price of Revlimid. So to recap here, the drug didn't get any better. The cancer patients didn't get any better. You just got better at making money. You just refined your skills at price gouging.
Compared with other high-income countries, the United States spends the most per capita on prescription drugs. But since the same material and almost the same workforce is employed in the U.S., shouldn't the price end up roughly the same? Yet in reality, when it comes to either the brand and the generic, they both come out with more money.
Some years ago, Congressman John Conyers from Detroit, Michigan, he's no longer alive, but he proposed expanded, improved Medicare for all legislation. And that basically would have taken the profit motive out of most of the healthcare system. Any company that wanted to participate in the Medicare for all program would have to be a nonprofit corporation. So there would be a lot more control over skyrocketing prices.
Now, much lower prices of the op prescription drugs such as atorvastatin, levothyroxine, lisinopril, and metformin are seen in countries like the United Kingdom, France and Italy, Canada, Germany and Japan. So how can the pricing of prescription drugs be assessed? And how affordable are they, and who are suffering the most due to these high costs?
Well, in the United States, the cost of prescription drugs is very high. If you don't have really good insurance, often they are unaffordable. And you asked why that is. It's because the pharmaceutical industry is an extremely powerful lobby. And they actually write the laws that Congress then passes, and they prevent legislation such as Medicare for All, which could lower drug prices.
Everyday costs for the people has recently surfaced in the news and among politicians. Yet nothing serious appears to be on the agenda to lower prescription drug costs. From the Biden administration to the Congress, no one seems to be serious to take meaningful efforts to address the issue. A key crucial piece of President Joe Biden's massive economic and climate package remains on ice on Capitol Hill.
The U.S. spends more on prescription drugs and healthcare in general than any other country in the world, and it's really not even close. We spend about $450 billion on prescription drugs. And these drugs, most of them are life-saving and can cost upwards from five figures a month. And really, it's only getting worse. Just as an example, insulin cost about $20 a vial back in the year, around the year 2000, and now it costs over $300. So you have a bad situation that's only getting worse.
Therefore, the people looking for affordable prescription drugs have no hope that they can get their hands on the drugs they need. And in some cases, lack of access to such drugs could have critical consequences and even end up being fatal for the patients. So why is the price for prescription drugs paid in America about two or three times higher than what other countries pay?
Well, that's really, we're really getting right into it then. I mean, it's for a number of reasons. First and foremost, it's the existence of monopolies. A lot of times with important drugs, you're going to have two or three companies that control most of the market. For example, again, using insulin, there's about three companies that control like 95% of the insulin on the market. What they can do is they can set the prices however they want for that reason. And of course, once you have genetic products entering the market, it can offset the problem with monopolies. But oftentimes, like, for example, with cancer drugs that are constantly getting newer and better, oftentimes by the time a patent expires, and now we're getting into patents, by the time a patent expires, the drug becomes obsolete.
Unlike in many other developed countries, there is no universal health care coverage in the U.S. Healthcare coverage is mostly provided through a private health insurance. There is, of course, the limited public health coverage, such as Medicare and Medicaid. Efforts to get the country closer to a comprehensive healthcare program have all been shut down by those promoting the idea that healthcare should also be subject to competition in the market.
You know, at the end of the day, public funding goes into a great deal of drug research, so the public has a right the fair pricing at the end of the day, but that's not what we're getting. I mean, just this year, drug companies have increased the price on over 500 drugs. You know, Pfizer, for example, Pfizer increased the price on 100 of the drugs, and that's after making record-shattering profits from their COVID vaccine. So really, it's about greed from the corporations and from the people who we've elected to serve us, who just want to fill their pockets. And, you know, this is really why we need an independent third party.
When it comes to healthcare, there is no solid governmental support for the people, and the poor are often victimized by insurance companies seeking profit. Given the fact that costs for basic necessities such as gasoline and groceries are quickly rising in America, how important is it to address the high costs of prescription drugs?
Well, it's very important because many Americans have to face a terrible choice of whether to spend what money they have on prescription drugs or on food or even on housing. People just can't make ends meet. And so what's needed, I think, is a government-funded healthcare system.
So it's no surprise that the high cost of prescription drugs has an immense impact on the large number of people relying on them. 66% of all adults in America use prescription drugs. Now that amounts to more than 131 million people. The utilization of such drugs is particularly high for the elderly and those with chronic conditions.
Prescription drugs is just one element of the disaster that's taking place here in the U.S. I mean, 60% of our population is a paycheck away from being homeless. They miss one paycheck and that's it. They're out on the street. But in terms of healthcare, I mean, you also have 60% of adults with chronic healthcare condition. Half of the people here in the United States take a prescription drug, and it's north of 90% for people over 65.
Data suggests that among those who take prescription medications in the United States, the average number of medications taken is 4. The USA is the country that spends the most on medication per capita, data suggests. The US healthcare system is embarrassingly notorious. People have to rely on the government, private health insurers, and individuals, but are not able to garner enough support.
What we need is public financing of elections, and that might require a constitutional amendment to overturn certain U.S. Supreme Court decisions, such as Buckley versus Valeo and Citizens United decision. So it will require political change in this country. You know, the people want affordable health care, like many other countries have, and the system is set up to prevent that from happening. We have institutionalized corruption in Washington, and the private financing of campaigns is the root of the problem.
This is while China remains the biggest producer of prescription drugs today. Until the mid-1990s, the U.S., Europe, and Japan produced over 90% of the global prescription drugs, but with the rise of China, that has all changed. So is there a correlation between the high cost of prescription drugs and corruption in the U.S. healthcare system?
I think the word corruption is interesting. I think what America has implemented now is legalized bribery of elected representatives and senators. It comes through campaign contributions. There are very few limits on how much money a given industry or billionaire can contribute to politicians' campaigns. And that's all legal. And that's the root of the problem.
With prices specified in the open market, costs for drugs and healthcare depend on market forces rather than the government. In the other developed nations, there are governmental programs aimed at partially controlling costs related to healthcare. Is there a correlation between the high costs of prescription drugs and corruption in the U.S. healthcare system?
Big Pharma, just last year, they spent north of $300 million on lobbying. There's three lobbyists for every Congress person in the U.S. And, you know, they're getting that money back somehow, right? When you spend $300 million, you're expecting to get a lot of it back, or more than it back, rather. And it's the consumer who pays for it. We actually had legislation here in the United States that prohibited Medicare from negotiating directly with manufacturers. And Medicare is the biggest provider of prescription drugs in this country. And they were prohibited from negotiating directly with manufacturers. And this all changed just a few months ago, but it's not going to take effect till 2023. And it's not even good enough.
Now, researchers estimate that 25% of people ages 65 to 69 take at least 5 prescription drugs to treat chronic conditions, a figure that jumps to nearly 46% for those between 70 and 79 years old. It should not, therefore, come across as a shock that the real impact of the pricey products is felt the most among senior citizens of American society.
There's a number of countries that have great healthcare systems, many of which are better than ours. And there's no reason that if they approve drugs, it has to go through a lengthy process here in the United States as well. And you know what? These are all things that I think are very easy to implement, set ceilings on pricing. I mean, there's a lot of things that are easy to do, but at the end of the day, the bottom line is that we don't have a Medicare for all plan. We don't have a national healthcare system. And some studies show that it could save nearly $1 trillion a year, you know, the majority of which would be administrative costs, but a good chunk of it is specifically prescription drugs.
Only in 2020, prescription drug spending increased to the whopping sum of $348.4 billion. Among the adults aged 60 to 79, the most commonly used types of prescription drugs are lipid-lowering drugs, antidiabetic agents, and beta blockers for high blood pressure or heart, all of which are crucial to sustain a person's well-being.
And at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about is one element of millions of people who are uninsured over here, right? So it's just window dressing. And, you know, the Democrats, they like to pat themselves on the back for giving us breadcrumbs, and that's really what it is. But at the end of the day, you know, it's this powerful lobbying that allows whenever there's a situation where there's a good idea, there's legislation that's going to be passed, it ends up getting watered down because that's when the lobbyists start to talk to the people that they have in Congress. And, you know, these lobbyists, they work with Republicans and Democrats. I mean, my senator here, Robert Mendez, is a Democrat, and he received nearly $100,000 last year from Big Pharma. And he supported these negotiations and then pats himself on the back, just like every other useless Democrat that we have.
Now, the high cost of prescription drugs has become particularly harsher during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. must tread the path that many other countries have adopted, that health care is a right rather than a commodity. However, in the U.S., it seems to be a privilege for the rich minority. The rest of the country is expected to spend huge sums of money on prescription medications.
And those savings would be even greater if we had a global health system. And I think now more than ever, you know, with the COVID pandemic and everything, we do need to think globally because, you know, we're not within these artificial lines that we call borders when it comes to COVID and when it comes to healthcare in general. So at the end of the day, what the Biden administration should do but will not do because the Democrats are useless is to implement a national healthcare system that puts people and their needs above profit.
On the other hand, the U.S. has to rein in the huge medical industrial complex, which only seeks to profit from the sales of prescriptions at an insanely high price. And now it's time we check in with Abbas Muntarim to see what he has prepared for us.
The American medical system is rooted in the genocide and enslavement of Africans. Its formation would not exist without both slavery and the racist capitalist system. Black people in America have been subjected to widespread medical apartheid, as the foundation of the medical and healthcare industry in the United States is in the dehumanizing and racist practice of slavery. During slavery, so-called doctors were hired by slave owners to examine enslaved Africans, and doctors relied on the slave economy to get business, and many of them owned slaves themselves. They used pseudoscience to come up with medicine, such as whipping, and they even invented fake diseases like drapetomania, which referred to when an enslaved African was making too many attempts to escape. These racist doctors, performed numerous racist experiments on enslaved Africans against their will. The so-called father of modern gynecology, J. Marion Sims, performed torturous experiments on enslaved black women without using any type of anesthesia. Doctors through the Tuskegee syphilis study lied about providing treatment for syphilis. And at the end of the 40-year study, despite there actually being a treatment for syphilis, only 74 of the 600 people in the experiment were still alive. Many of these medical advancements was due to treating Africans like lab rats. And the list, it goes on and on about the genocidal actions that this country, that this medical industry has done to our people. And people wonder why we have such distrust in this racist system. This system of medical apartheid has led to revolutionaries and radicals attempting to fill the gap and provide free services, free healthcare for our people. One example is through the Black Panther Party. In 1970, Bobby Seale, who was the chairman of the Black Panther Party, he issued an organization directive that all party chapters establish free healthcare facilities, which they called People's Free Medical Clinics. Through these programs, the Black community was able to receive free health services that actually benefited them. The Black Panther Party, they also realized that sickle cell research was being neglected by the government, as sickle cell affects Black people the most, so the government didn't care. The Black Panther Party created a national screening program so that Black people could know their status. This work was improving the health of the community, and the United States government viewed the Black Panther Party as a threat. And they launched an illegal counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO to destroy the Black Panther Party. Mutombo Shakur, who was a member of the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, and was an organizer, activist, and a healthcare worker, as well as a revolutionary, he created free acupuncture clinics to combat addiction from the opioid epidemic. During the Vietnam War, the government through the CIA, they began smuggling in heroin into the country. This, just like crack, had devastating impacts on the Black community. Mutombo, he successfully used acupuncture to treat addiction that heroin causes. And Mutombo, he ended up being arrested by the U.S. government for his organizing efforts and has been a political prisoner and is still incarcerated to this day. This shows us that even as we build infrastructure to support our people's health, the government will destroy it, yet again showing this apartheid system for what it is. If we look at the condition of Black people's health in America today, it is still nothing short of genocidal. Black people in cities across America have had some of the highest death rates from COVID-19. And when it comes to health access, nearly 4.4 million Black people don't have health insurance. In terms of Black male and female life expectancy, on average, it's lower than white males and females. And Black men and women both have higher blood pressure compared to whites. Black women also have higher risk for mortality while giving birth, and Black infants have the highest rate of infant mortality, over double the rate of whites. Doctors today still have these racist understandings of medicine that was rooted in the enslavement of Africans. For example, in a 2016 survey, they found that around half of white medical students and residents that were sampled held racist views about biological differences between Black and white people. And 25% of medical residents thought that Black people have thicker skin than whites. These people surveyed also endorsed more racist beliefs about biological differences between Black and white people, which led them to having racist treatment recommendations. All of these health disparities didn't come out of a vacuum. Rather, it's a product of the development of this country. This corporate healthcare system is rooted in the genocidal system of slavery, and slavery was all about mass profits. And today, the medical industry is all about profit too. When profit is the driving factor behind health, of course, there'll be racism ingrained within the system. While there's been significant advancements in medical technology at the expense of Black people are still bearing the burden of lack of health access and have some of the highest rates of diseases. Throughout centuries of history, it is clear that this colonial regime will not provide us true access to healthcare. We must begin to build our own healthcare system, our own hospitals, and have our own doctors if we are truly going to begin to build a healthy community. This is Power to the People.
And thank you very much, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and please join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life.
همه چیز رو تعلیم داده.
It has taught us everything.
باید آموخت.
باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed the explanation of Surah Najm, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Qamar, which is number 54 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 55 ayahs. It opens with cataclysmic sign of the end of the world coming and the moon having a split apart. It takes its name from the opening ayah, which mentions the moon or Qamar, that here serves as a reference to the day of resurrection. The surah deals mainly with the punishment dealt out to the previous generations of disbelievers. These were presented as a warning to the pagans of Mecca, and are also relevant to the disbelievers of all times. with the refrain, "Is there anyone who will be admonished?" running throughout the surah. Finally, the treatment of the disbelievers on the Day of Judgment is contrasted to the everlasting bliss the believers will enjoy in paradise. An interesting feature of this surah is that all 55 of its ayahs end with the letter R. A narration from the Prophet of Islam says, "Whoever recites Surah Qamar and perseveres will enter the plane of judgment in splendor on the day of resurrection on condition of having acted upon Quranic injunctions." Let us start with ayah 1, 2, and 3 of Surah Qamar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. اقتربت الساعة وانشق القمر وإن يروا آية يعرضوا ويقولوا سحر مستمر وكذبوا واتبعوا أهواءهم وكل أمر مستقر.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The hour has drawn near and the moon is split. If they see a sign, they turn away and say, "An incessant magic." They denied and followed their own desires, and every matter has a setting appropriate to it. The opening ayah, which mentions the drawing near of the hour, is a reference to the inevitability of the Day of Resurrection as the most significant alteration in the world of creation that after death and revival opens a new life in the hereafter. It is a realm whose greatness and extent are indescribable and unintelligible to us, because of attachment to the materialistic world. In other words, resurrection is close to us. It is a constant reminder that life of the mortal world is transient, which means we ought to be attentive and prepare for the provision of the hereafter. The opening ayah ends with the Arabic words shaqul qamar, or splitting of the moon, which is a reference to a famous miracle of the Prophet of Islam recorded in several eyewitness accounts, and is an undeniable proof of divine omnipotence over all things. It was performed at the insistent demand of the Arab pagans and the Jews. At night, the Prophet performed prayer and prostration to God and supplicated, at which, to the amazement of the onlookers, the full moon was cleft asunder. The Jews who had read in the Torah how God made the sun and the moon stand still for Prophet Joshua, the successor of Prophet Moses, peace upon them, accepted the truth of Islam on seeing this miracle. But Abu Jahl, the leader of the pagan Arabs of Mecca, refused to believe and called it magic, as Ayah 2 says, "If they see a sign, they turn away and say, an incessant magic." The splitting of the moon was not any deception of the eyesight of the onlookers in Mecca, since this phenomenon was witnessed by travelers to Syria and was also visible in far-off India, as testified by inscriptions on monuments in Kerala, where King Chakravarti Perumal of the Malabar region, seeing this strange sight, and later on learning that the last prophet had appeared in the Arabian Peninsula, made a journey to Mecca and became a Muslim. A scientific proof of this miracle is the deep scar or rift discovered on the moon and photographed by NASA astronomers in the US, which is further proof of such a phenomenon occurring in the past. According to exegetes, when resurrection draws near, the moon will also cleft asunder. As is clear by Ayah 3, it is the habit of obdurate disbelievers to belie the truth of the prophetic call, of miracles, and of the inevitability of resurrection, because they follow their concupiscent desires, without realizing that everyone receives the reward and recompense of their own deeds, since nothing shall be effaced in this world. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the day of resurrection will certainly occur no matter the disbelievers deny the truth, including the universal mission of the seal of messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Number two, the miracles are not a matter of surprise, since everything, including the wonders of nature, is in the power of the Almighty Creator, who granted the Prophet of Islam several miracles, of which the greatest and the eternal is the Noble Quran, whose flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom no one has been able to match. And number three, obstinate persons call miracles a magic and deny the manifest truth because of their immersion in carnal desires. Now let us listen to ayahs 4 and 5 of the same surah.
وَلَقَدْ جَاءَهُمْ مِنَ الْأَنْبَاءِ مَا فِيهِ مُزْدَجَرٌ حِكْمَةٌ بَالِغَةٌ فَمَا تُغْنِ النُّذُرُ.
There have already come to them, the disbelievers, reports containing admonishment and representing far-reaching wisdom, but warnings are of no avail. The account of the ancients and the divine wrath that struck them for their abominable sins and unpardonable crimes against humanity are mentioned in the Noble Quran as admonishment for all in order to desist from the falsehood. But the intransigent disbelievers never heed these far-reaching or profound words of wisdom. In other words, the fate that befell the past nations ought to open our eyes, since the apparent triumph of tyranny and evil is short-lived, and it is truth that eventually triumphs. There is inevitable reckoning on the Day of Judgment. Ayah 5 points out that the Noble Quran is wisdom per excellence. The opponents of truth are aware of the fate of the misled nations of the past. Yet they continue their evil deeds and denial of facts and realities, thereby bringing destruction upon themselves, despite the long respite the all-merciful God has given for repentance and reform. The ayahs of the Noble Quran, which are for all time and all places, thus seal the argumentation so that people hear the truth, ponder upon it, and decide to take the course of action. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, reflection on the history and fate of the nations of the past help us discover the truth and the causes of destruction of the ancient civilizations. Number two, the message of the Noble Quran is based on wisdom and logic. And number three, prophets proclaim the truth in order to seal the argumentation for mankind, since facts cannot be forced upon anyone and there is no compulsion in their acceptance, as the Almighty has given us the intellect to discern between good and evil, which eventually determines reward or punishment. In conclusion of this week's episode, let us listen to ayahs 6, 7, and 8 of Surah Qamar.
فَتَوَلَّ عَنْهُمْ يَوْمَ يَدْعُو الدَّاعِ إِلَى شَيْءٍ نُكُرٍ خُشَّ عَنْ أَبْصَارُهُمْ يَخْرُجُونَ مِنَ الْأَجْدَاثِ كَأَنَّهُمْ جَرَادٌ مُنْتَشِرٌ مهطعين إلى الداعي يقول الكافرون هذا يوم عسير.
So turn away from them, the day when the caller calls for a dire thing. With a humbled look in their eyes, they will emerge from their graves as if they were a scattered locust, scrambling toward the summoner. The faithless will say, "This is a hard day." Ayah 6 addresses the Prophet of Islam and means to say that when disbelievers refuse to believe even after witnessing such great miracles, you leave them to their fate without taking more trouble in the hope of removing their ignorance, but convey the message that when the day the divine caller calls people towards a horrible thing, that is the resurrection for the final judgment on the basis of the record of everyone's deeds, they will have no clue to what awaits them. As the next ayah means to say, the humbling eyes is a token of intensity of fear or shamefulness of the disbelievers and sinners. The similitude of disbelievers and sinners on the day of resurrection to scattered locusts reflects their perplexity and astonishment upon coming out of graves and hastening hither and thither and witnessing the torment on that day. In other words, when they leave their graves upon the call, they protrude their necks toward the calling angels out of the intensity of fear. It is but natural that when a horrible sound is heard, people immediately protrude their neck and then turn toward its source, hasten toward it, and have no other choice but to make their presence at the divine tribunal. As Ayah 8 means to say, the horror of the hard incidents of that day encompasses them all, since all the things cause fear in sinners. May God Almighty bestow His mercy upon His servants. On that day, there shall be neither fear nor grief for the believers. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, unsealing the argumentation, the faithless should be left to their own fate, to accept the truth or to deny it, since God has given the freedom to choose reward or punishment. Number two, the sins of the day of resurrection are extremely horrible for the faithless and the sinners. Unimaginable consequences indeed. And number three, Resurrection is physical, and all mankind will be brought to life in their original shape for the final judgment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%. Which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the U.S. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government in Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And, you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Pereza, London.
Yuan has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the NAFTA and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas and petrochemical companies, join Yuan's energy exchange on futures platform, Yuan's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while they are also some strong hedging tools.
They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange